Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly conversation on current affairs in China coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studio here in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, and with me, as always, is the inscrutable Jeremy Goldborn, the
very
man behind
me. Good evening, Kaiser. I'm not scruting at all.
But I shall not scrute you. Jeremy, of course, is the man behind danwei.com, and how are you, man?
I'm good. I'm very good.
Okay, so we've got an outstanding lineup for you this week to provide a preview and give some context for next month's 18th Party Congress. Joining us are Patrick Chovanec, a professor of business at Tsinghua University and a frequent commentator on Chinese politics and economics. Welcome to the show, Patrick.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
We're also delighted to have Jamil Anderlini, bureau chief of the Financial Times in Beijing and author most recently of The Bo Xilai Scandal, Power, Death, and Politics in China. This, Jamil, is your first appearance on Seneca, so welcome to the show, Jamil.
Thank you, Kaiser.
And finally, we welcome back John Garneau, reporter for the Sydney Morning Herald, and also the author of a book on the Bo scandal, another book on the Bo scandal, this one coming out very soon in Australia. What, this will be October, 26th?
We roll it out right away in Australia, and then a week later in the UK, and probably the US too.
Okay, great. And the title of that book is The Rise and Fall of the House of Bo, How a Murder Exposed the Cracks in China's Leadership, and it's published by Penguin. And it'll be available in the U.S. when?
In about a week, I'd say.
Okay, about a week.
I think it's only fair at this point that we also say Jamil's book is available already online on Amazon.com.
Right. It's been out since
iTunes.
Jamil, when did that come out?
And something called Kobo.com. It came out about a month ago.
And it's only $1.32, I believe.
It's an ebook and it's 99 pence.
Yeah, and
it's
very much worth a read.
Thank
Certainly
you.
Worth the money.
It's based on a shorter article that we ran earlier in the year. It's updated and a longer version of that. So.
Okay, well, before we jump right in with conversation, we remind readers that they can join in our conversation at our Facebook page at facebook.com/SenecaPodcast or on the podcast page itself, where they can also find links to the things that we talk about on today's show. Let me also note that Seneca will join forces with the British Chamber of Commerce next month to bring you a live debate here in Beijing on a topic related to China's foreign relations. We hope that you'll be able to join us for that, and we'll have more details on that next week. Mark your calendars for Thursday, November 29th. If we're lucky, Patrick is going to be joining us for that. We'll see. Anyway, so let's save that date, Patrick. Yeah. We also have another Seneca Live event coming up in December. This one with a fun twist, which we will announce sometime very, very soon. So let's get started. The upcoming Party Congress can't be understood at all, really, without a grasp on the bizarre and baffling story that unfolded this year, the Bo Xilai and Gu Kailai scandal. So let's start off by talking about Jamil's book and, of course, John's forthcoming book, at which I've had a small sneak preview. So, John, first to you, your book promises some new detail on what transpired at the Chengdu consulate in early February. So are there any spoilers that you can provide for us here on Seneca?
Yeah, well, I think this is nice and intimate in the Chengdu consulate. One of my favorite bits is when the state security vice minister was about to lead Wang Lijun, the police chief, away from the U.S. consulate. And he chartered a PLA plane to take them back to Beijing.
Mm-hmm.
But Wang Lijun said, oh, there's just one more condition. I'm not going on any chartered plane. It has to be a fully packed civilian passenger airline because I reckon Bo Xilai is going to blow it up.
He just remembers Lin Biao.
he was thinking Lin Biao. He's probably also thinking, I don't know if you remember, 10 years ago there was a plane crash in Liaoning province. And there's lots of intrigue about that. 100 people died and... And one of the many probably fanciful accusations being thrown against Bo's family is he may have had a role in that. So that's what Wang Lijun, that was the excuse that Wang Lijun made at the time.
It was 10 years ago and it was Liaoning after all, so there's room for speculation. So anything else about Chengdu? No, you don't want, okay, so you want people to buy the book. I understand. I mean, commercial interests must be taken into account here. And Jamil, what are readers going to, who have been following the Bo trial or the whole scandal, what are they likely to find that's new or controversial or otherwise remarkable in your book? I've read it and I think the whole thing is excellent, but let's hear what you got.
Well, one of my favorite little bits, which we included in the book, was... Bo Xilai's obsession with Sylvester Stallone. Apparently, he went to the Chinese embassy in Washington, D.C., and he asked he asked them to set up some get some top U.S. Visitors to come to Dalian to visit the city when he was the mayor there. This is in the late 90s. And the Chinese embassy, without really knowing who he wanted, came up with a list. They had Henry Kissinger, they had Jimmy Carter, and Bo Xilai got their list, and he turned around and said, no, that's not what I want. I want Sylvester Stallone. So the poor folks at the Chinese diplomats in the embassy in D.C. had to go and ask Sly's agent whether he was available, and they kindly told the Chinese diplomats he was booked for the next 4 years. So poor old Bo Xilai ended up with Alexander Haig and was somewhat disappointed by
who
that.
Who was in charge here? I mean, it's easy.
Yeah.
That's really amusing. I remember that part. That really stuck out at me, too. And what did that say about Bo, though? I mean, deluded, right? I mean, that he was...
Yeah, he really believed, I think, that he was really an important person in the world, that he was a grand global statesman who crossed borders and people should see him as, that Sylvester Stallone, a mere actor in the U.S., should come running when the party, Communist Party Secretary of Dalian City called him, especially because he was a princeling, he was a powerful member of this important family. So,
okay, so let's talk a little bit about the Congress itself now, and specifically the shadow that the whole Bo affair has cast on it. I mean, it's certainly a long shadow. They've tried to sort of tidy things up in advance of announcing the Congress. Some of the trials Gu Kailai's trial is over. Bo Xilai has already been removed from the party. Wang Lijun's trial. Are there loose ends still before things get started?
Well, I think one of the key unanswered questions, and we're sort of finding out this week and next week, is as they reshuffle the members of the top military members, who of Bo Xilai's friends are going to be sidelined because of their connections to Bo Xilai. And one of the key questions is one of his princeling friends, Liu Yuan, the son of Liu Shaoqi. And it looks like he might be missing out on a top PLA spot. I don't think it's completely closed yet. That's a big deal if it's true, because he was one of Xi Jinping's close friends as well.
Right. So actually, Jeremy Page from The Journal ran a piece about that, how it looks like Liu Yuan has been passed over. It actually quotes Steve Zhang, who says that, the important thing, I think, what was the exact quote? Something like, the important thing is that the point is it's not Liu Yuan, referring to... Liu Yuan himself, I think a lot of military brass in the States are breathing a little sigh of relief that Liu Yuan isn't being promoted in the CMC because, of course, he's known for making quite belligerent remarks.
Yeah, that's right. But I also don't think it's completely closed yet, because there's still they still haven't announced the very top rank of military appointments. But if he's finished, that means... That's a big deal for Xi Jinping. Maybe it makes it slower for him to consolidate his power. Maybe it, some of his enemies used to talk about him as another Bo Xilai. So maybe it makes the whole thing more stable. It's a bit hard to say.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the things that is hard to fully grasp just looking at the Bo Xilai scandal, is that with the patronage system in China, you essentially have, with this leadership transition, not just 7 or 9 positions up, but all the people who depend on those people, all the people who look to them, or the people under them as their godfathers or patrons. Mm-hmm. And so you've got, what the Communist Party is about 5% of the population. I mean, essentially everyone's career path for the next 10 years is going to be determined by whether the people who they've cozied up to get the promotion that they desire. And so, the trickle-down effect on everybody. And then, of course, beyond that 5%, you're talking about all the people who have cozied up, who are not party members, who have cozied up to party members. And so there's a lot of there's just a big trickle-down effect on people throughout the country.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
I just wanted to make a point. It's really one thing that's astonishing about all this is that these are people who grew up together. So these are people who literally, spend Chinese New Year together. They're people who all went to the same schools. They're people, at the very top, there's about half of them are princelings. Half of them are people whose parents were top officials. It sort of fluctuates a bit, but there's probably more princelings in the top level of government than there were before. these days. And you've got to remember that, you know, when you get rid of Bo Xilai, you're not just getting rid of a political competitor, you're getting rid of someone you went to high school with. I mean, it's quite astonishing when you see, when the knives come out, how these sort of long-held, and John's written a fair bit about this, the long-held grudges that come out and how, you know, you're taking down childhood friends. It's quite, yeah, I mean, quite astonishing.
But I mean, taking down childhood friends in this country for that generation also means taking down people that you may have, in fact, stabbed in the back during the Cultural Revolution.
Once or twice before.
Exactly.
Well,
that's not new. Right?
That's the point. So it's taking down childhood friends. It's also taking down enemies. You've held a grudge for, you know, the guy who bullied you at high school. You're like, finally, we get to take down Bo Xilai. He flicked spitballs at my head when I was, you know, 10.
But the point is that Chinese politics, especially elite Chinese politics, is personal.
Yeah, very personal.
Highly personal. Right. While we were talking about that one part of the trifecta, the Central Military Commission is one piece of it, as well as, of course, the party post of General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party and the government post of President. But let's stick with the CMC for now. Another piece of that actually, it was you, John, right? You had done this piece in Foreign Policy. Is that correct? About Xi's background, about his father and his father's ties to his father, what's his name? Xi Zhongxin. He worked in the secretariat of the Central Military Commission.
Xi Jinping himself worked in the secretariat of the Central Military Commission basically as soon as he's finished the Cultural Revolution.
Oh, that's right. He did, right? Not his father.
Yeah, but I think his Xi Jinping's family's ties with Bo Xilai are really, really interesting and nasty and kind of wonderful. So the Bo family, Bo Yibo, Bo's father, mm-hmm. and Xi Zhongxun, Xi's father, they clashed a few times, probably right from the start with the first purge of the People's Republic, really, with Gao Gang, sort of patron against patron. And in 1987 is the famous party life meeting where the great Liberal Party secretary, Hu Yaobang, was purged. And it was Bo Yibo who led the purge, who chaired the meeting, and it was Xi Zhongxun who was the only elder, along with Wanli, to stand up for Hu Yaobang. And so that's a divide which hasn't healed to this date. And one of the most interesting little kind of snippets I came across was when the moment that Xi Zhongxun died in 2002, and he died at 5:30 in the morning, by 9:30 in the morning, there was the peace kind of olive branch from Bo Yibo. To the family, and it was a couplet. It was a poetic couplet which acknowledged a conversation, a remark that Mao Zedong had made, which had corrected Bo Yibo when Bo Yibo sort of dismissed Xi Zhongxun back in 1952. And Mao said, "No, this guy's the real thing. He's been forged in the Taoist furnace of immortality in the early 50s. And I just thought, wow, that's really kind of intergenerational planning on Bo Yibo's part to sort of begin to build a bridge between the children because they needed each other.
Right. That's interesting. It actually goes back, you said, to the Gao Gang thing in the early 1950s, the Gao Gang and Zhao Shushu when they were...
Right. So, I mean, Gao Gang at its this is the first purge, 1954, 55, and Gao Gang was Xi Zhongxun's patron from northwest China, very successful, ambitious, capable cadre. He thought he had, and he did, I think, Mao's endorsement to take a few kind of... to cut Liu Shaoqi, the number two, down a few pegs. Mm-hmm. But it backfired. Mao abandoned Gao Gang. And so Liu Shaoqi, who was the patron to Bo Yibo, sort of got his revenge. And the result of that was Gao Gang was purged. He committed suicide, the only senior leader to ever top themselves.
Uh-huh.
And so that sort of turned around where Xi Zhongxun's patron started as the aggressor and ended up being the victim. And Bo Yibo was on the other side of that.
My God. Okay, so deep roots to this factional strife. Let's see. So we've seen actually quite a bit of discussion about prospects for meaningful reform with the 18th Party Congress. Do you think that there's any chance that we're going to see something like the 1992 Jiang Zemin Southern? By the Deng Xiaoping Southern Tour back in 92, that we'll see Xi Jinping use the political moment to announce deepening of commitment to economic and or political reforms. Patrick?
Well, so we've seen these the new leadership generation be good followers. That's how they've gotten to where they are. What we haven't seen is them be leaders. Mm-hmm. And so whether they take on a new guys, whether they continue to be good followers in a sense that it's just all kind of consensus driven and they're cautious and they don't want to lead from the front, or whether actually they emerge from their shells and either Xi Jinping or Li Keqiang take on that kind of role and say, well, this is my vision and here's how we're going to pursue it and actually spend political capital. That really remains to be seen.
Do you have either of you have an opinion on whether they're willing to break the eggs necessary to make this omelet?
I think we probably are going to see a grand gesture. We're going to see new slogans. We're going to see, if you look back at when Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao took over, within weeks you had new slogans. You had a clear change in direction from the previous administration. But whether there's going to be substance behind it, I mean, the word reform has been completely hijacked by people who don't want anything like reforms, who the word democracy, I mean, Hu Jintao used it 35 times in the last Congress, right? I mean,
right.
So or 40 something times.
China is a country under rule of law, Jamil.
Full rule of law, socialist rule of law with Chinese characteristics, Jeremy. But I think, you know, you're going to see for sure. I think they recognize what they need to do to rebuild legitimacy, what they need to do to shore up, you know, their right to rule in this country and to get all the different interest groups on side looking like they're attacking some of the interest groups. But I think the reality is they won't do anything really major unless they're facing a crisis.
Yeah, I mean, the conventional view is that the Chinese leadership takes about a year to form some kind of agenda. And I think the conventional view within the leadership is they have about 2 to 3 years, at least on the economic front, that they have about 2 to 3 years to affect some of the reforms that they need to make this transition from an export and investment-driven economy to a more consumption-driven economy. I mean, I'm actually a big skeptic of that. I think that the events will move much more rapidly on the economic front, that they will be forced to respond to a deteriorating economy. And slogans certainly aren't going to cut it in that case. But we'll see. I mean, there's a lot of disagreement if you ask economic analysts about what's going to happen even in the next quarter.
Sure. Let me just throw one line of disagreement at you here. Isn't there evidence that they've shown the political will to take on one very, very important entrenched interest that's real estate developers? They have, for a couple of years now, shown a willingness to take some of the air out by deliberately suppressing speculation in the real estate market in the big cities.
Right. The standard line is that the real estate downturn that we're seeing is a function of government policy, that the government has implemented cooling measures. And mm-hmm. actually, I disagree with that. I remember when the government began to implement cooling measures in April of 2010. If you look at the statistics, I would argue that it shows that those cooling measures had almost no impact on the overall growth of sales or the level of investment that took place, and that if it did have an effect, it was shifting the investment boom away from first-tier cities to second- and third-tier cities. And if you actually see the prices rise immediately after that. So for about a year and a half, nothing happened. And then what happened was developers, I think, were induced to believe that there was all this pent-up demand. Mm-hmm. They accumulated lots of unsold inventory. And it was actually that unsold inventory. It was the financing, the availability of financing as the PBOC began to try to combat inflation. Mm-hmm. That there simply wasn't enough financing to go around and to support all those inventories.
And that's what sucked the air out of the bubble.
Well, and at the end of the summer of last year, there was a fire sale. They had to liquidate their inventories. I think, you know, I would argue that if it was the restrictive policies that were dragging this market down, what you would have expected to see was first a decline in sales, followed by a rise in inventories, followed by a fall off in prices. And in fact, what we saw was sales remaining fairly strong, a rise in inventories as developers overbuilt, mm-hmm. followed by a fall in prices, then only then a fall off in sales as people said, well, the prices are going down, maybe I shouldn't be in such a rush to buy.
Okay, well, this is a topic big enough for an entire podcast on its own. So let's hop back into politics. And the other entrenched interest, of course, is the party itself, where I think it's been – if there's one thing that this this year has taught us, it's that corruption goes up quite a bit higher than anyone had ever believed, now that the wealth of Bo Xilai's family has been, you know, not
and
sort of laid bare.
And Xi Jinping's family.
If Mike Forsyth is to be believed, right? Let's of course, you know, Bloomberg is
that dodgy news agency, Bloomberg, known for propaganda and made up headlines and stuff.
But yeah, so but corruption, I mean, that's obviously the biggest problem that needs to be tackled. The party is at least ostensibly aware of that. Is there a political will to take this on, or will forcing more transparency among party leaders about their finances, will that destroy the party?
That's a pretty big question. Look, I reckon there are two little kind of straws in the wind which the optimists can grab onto. One, you can take a different view to Patrick's, and you can say that industry is squealing, but the government's not doing everything it could to bail them out at the moment. Heavy industry, real estate developers, and all the kind of the patrons of that industry that go right to into the central committee, really. So they're taking a bit of a hit on the economy, and they're prepared to do that, arguably to help restructure the economy. That's a good sign. Mm-hmm. And the second really, I think, important sign is the way they threw everything at Bo Xilai in the Politburo meeting a few weeks ago. I mean, it looks like Bo Xilai is going to be charged with just about everything.
Every crime imaginable. Yeah,
that's right. Possibly.
Improper sexual relations with many women.
Yes.
And that's right. So you can imagine... if everything kind of falls into place, and this is if upon if, that's a nice kind of rallying point for a new sort of consensus where you rally against not only Bo Xilai the bloke, but everything he stood for, and you frame everything he stood for as abusing law, letting corruption go out of control, and not having any kind of accountability. So all I'd say is it's very, very tough, but it's not impossible that there's going to be some progress.
Well, that is the line that the government wants to put out there.
Right,
that,
before you go into an attack on this idea that they're allowing the economy to shrink.
No. I'm talking about politics here.
Good.
That the line on Bo Xilai that they want is that, see, this is a complete aberration. This is a guy who was out of control, loose cannon, and we're going to squash him. And that's the party's going to cleanse its laundry and demonstrate its purity. The danger, though, is that they lose control of that narrative, and that what people take away is that we knew that the local officials were corrupt, and actually it goes right to the top. And we had a feeling that they were all going around doing this stuff. And anything that they bring out about Bo Xilai actually then splashes back on them. And given the level of cynicism that's out there, that's expressed on Weibo and other kind of forums, where people, if the government says that 10 people were killed in an accident, people think that there's 100 people that were killed in an accident, right?
Multiply.
So that's the danger is that for the government is that it's instead of throwing water on the fire, it's throwing gasoline on the fire.
And that's magnified, obviously, because of the fact of social media now. I mean, this is the first leadership transition taking place in the age of microblogging, right? I mean, in 2007, you know, we had bloggers, but it wasn't anything close to this, I mean, to the phenomenon that we're seeing today. Jamil, do you have some thoughts on how this changes things? I mean, besides what Patrick just alluded to.
Yeah, I see it in my own life when I look around at Chinese friends. My wife's Chinese. I look around at people in my life, and what has just absolutely blown me away in the last few years is that people who before were completely uninterested in politics, who would, you know, just be like, oh, anyone involved in politics is, you know, anyone making a fuss is usually just a loser who can't get ahead in this society, and you know, they're just making a fuss for no reason. Those people now are the same people calling me up or sending me emails saying, why aren't you writing about this person, this dissident? What I think we can't underestimate the power of Weibo, you know, of microblogs. I think it's completely changed a huge segment of society, the middle classes. I think it's awakened them. I think it really has made a lot of people aware that there are a lot of people out there who are suffering from injustice and the lack of human rights, lack of rights in general, and those people are quite like them. before it was all out of sight, out of mind. Now it's in their face every day on their Weibo.
Dissenting
where's
views.
People on the high speed train who lost their lives in Wenzhou, who are basically their peers, right? That's the difference.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, and you know what's really struck me is not just people who weren't politically engaged before, but people who are actually beneficiaries of the system. People who are executives in state-owned enterprises or mid to medium high-level party members who in private conversation will be very cynical, very pessimistic, and say the system's broken or corruption. I mean, they may be involved in corruption, but they feel like it's out of control. And that
someone's always making more than them.
Yeah, exactly.
But you get to see the numbers on Weibo. They're like, damn, I'm only earning this.
Yeah, but you know, when the beneficiaries, short. I mean, you can understand when people who are
the losers,
the victims, right?
And these are, yeah,
but the beneficiaries start speaking very cynically about the system. I think you're absolutely right.
And those are the people who 5 years ago would defend the system to people like me and John and Patrick. These are the people who would say, no, the system is rotten at the bottom, but, you know, at the top it's all good. And now those are the people who are arguing that it's all gone to hell.
Let's get back to directly talking about the upcoming party Congress. Reuters has put out a list of what they claim are the 7 members of the new Politburo Standing Committee, which have been apparently approved in a secret meeting between the former president, Jiang Zemin, the current president, Hu Jintao, and of course the incoming president, who will be president next March, presumably, Xi Jinping. This list is of 7 people that includes Xi Jinping himself, of course, Li Keqiang, Wang Xishan, Zhang Dejiang, who else is on there? Liu Yunshan, Liu Yunchao, and then Zhang Gaoli. What do you guys think of this? Do you think this is credibly sourced? What have you guys
Can I jump in here? Because on Saturday you'll be able to read
the real list.
Okay. No. So I have a different view on this. So let me just say, the reporter who from Reuters who put together that list, in 2007 he won the Scoop of the Year award for Reuters internally because he put out the list that ended up being the real list 3 weeks before. So, I mean, I think he's got – we can say quite a lot of confidence that he's got good sources and that, you know, he got it right last time. There's no reason to suggest – you know, to see why he won't have got it right this time. But I take it – you know, from our perspective at the Financial Times, we take a bit of a different view. We think most of our readers have never heard of any of these people. We think they probably don't care, really. If unless you're a real, close China watcher, you won't know who these people are and you don't really care. From our perspective, I think most of our readers care more about the fact that 3 weeks before these people are supposed to take power, there are 20 different lists out there. Right. There are all sorts of constellations. Nobody knows if it's going to be 7 people or 9 people. Nobody knows who the people will be on that final list, really. And this is the world's second largest economy.
What their portfolios will hold, right?
And what portfolios they have and what they're going to do. I mean,
and
it's mad.
If they stand for anything at all, we don't know, do
right.
we? We don't know what any of them stand for. I mean, every time you see any of them described as either reformers or hardliners, it's really complete nonsense because we don't know. They're all robots.
We don't even know really which faction. You know, you hear about factions, princelings and non-princelings. In the end, nobody's really even sure about that. So to me, the point is more that this is how... Look at this system and look at this process and look at all the speculation. It's so opaque as to be, totally anachronistic, really.
So, Kaz, if I add together what Jamil and Patrick are saying, and I don't disagree with anything they're saying, that adds up to a story where actually the system's broken, right? There's no, no change is not tenable if they want to keep control of the show. So the question is, do they have the internal coherence to save themselves? And my personal guess is they probably will give it a bit of a shot. They won't just let it all kind of go down in a screaming mess just yet.
Patrick, you were shaking your head at when Jamil was talking about the standard models about factions here. You know, we describe everyone in terms of a princeling faction or the Communist Youth League faction.
Well, I should explain. I was shaking my head up and down.
In agreement. Yes. No, but I think you were shaking your head at the conventional wisdom.
That's,
which is I meant you were agreeing with.
I agree, because, you know, one of the things I was afraid of when I came in here was that we're going to go down the list and try to talk about each of these people who are in the list of 7 to 9 people. And I think that, you know, after there are a few of them who are obviously, you know, we know something about them. Wang Qishan, you know, has been very visible as a fixer, right? So Wang Yang has been, if he's in the, you know, in the group.
He's not really on anyone's
list,
right?
But I mean, you know, he's been around.
He's on your list. Okay.
He's been in the discussions of people who are candidates, right? And we know that he's sort of the, at least been identified as the
most
standard bearer for reformers. Although, again, you know, whether he really is or not is an open question. But a lot of these people, you know, unless you have had, if you're outside the system, unless you have had the incidental good fortune to interact with them, you know, on some close basis or know them through someone, it's very hard, certainly not from their official biographies, you will learn anything more than a handful of things. And even those things may be deceptive in the sense that they may lead you to conclude, oh, this person's a traditionalist. But in fact, you know, they actually harbor very, very different views. So it's I think there's a lot of reading of tea leaves and a lot of sort of seizing on, oh, he said this once and this means that he's a reformer. And we don't – the truth is we don't really know, and we don't really know about the dynamics between these people as well in terms of policy formation and in terms of politics.
And which unfortunately seems to be the most important thing to
all the things that we want to know about a politician, right? You know, what are their formative life experiences? Where have they ended up on different policy matters? Who are their allies? Who are their enemies? All these things, unless you dig deeply, like, you know, like these two guys have done in certain cases. But, you know, Bo Xilai is a really colorful, interesting person who attracts people to look in. There are a lot of other guys who are sort of a plain vanilla, at least on the outside,
right.
and we haven't delved. But yet they could be very important players. They could be one of the seven.
One thing that we do know from their official biographies is what they were educated in. Mm-hmm. And one of the most striking things to me, somebody who actually, you know, looked quite a bit at the phenomenon of technocracy when I was a graduate student, is that in 2007, 5 years ago, at the 17th Party Congress, the 9 members of the Politburo Standing Committee, of them, only one was not formally trained as an engineer. Now, if we take Reuters' list to be correct, of the 7, only one is an engineer. The other 6 are a grab bag of economists and lawyers, an historian in the case of Wang Qishan.
I would just make the point, though, that according to Xi Jinping's official biography, he has a degree in, I think it's law, right? I mean, is it law or economics?
No, it's
in Marxist studies, on the job Marxist studies. If you go and talk to the people who, you know, the official biography for foreign consumption is he has a law degree. But right, it's actually Marxist studies.
He has an undergraduate degree actually also in chemical engineering.
Though. Sure, that's right. But I mean his graduate degree, you know, his PhD.
Right.
His PhD is in Marxist studies, but on his official biography, they fudge it and call it law.
So. But this does represent a generational change. I mean, the previous generation grew up during the time of either during or just after sort of the Soviet influence in which you know, engineering – science, technology, building the country in a physical way was the dominant thing, and those were the people who rose to the top. And the new generation came of age during as young people during the Cultural Revolution, but as going to college, really during the initial days of openness to the humanities and law and economics. And so it really is a very significant shift because it's a different perspective on many of the challenges that face China today.
Yeah, John? And then this cohort, like one of the things that always strikes me is how people of this younger generation are very dismissive of their previous generation. And so Hu Jintao's cohort were the cohort who kind of survived by doing nothing and saying nothing and just surviving on university campuses during the Cultural Revolution. They missed out on the fun of the anarchy of breaking out of school. They missed out on going down to the countryside and hanging out with the peasants for 3 or 5 or 8 years during the Cultural Revolution.
What fun that was.
You know, these guys get very nostalgic about those times. And they also missed out on having real open-minded university experiences in that moment of sunshine after the Cultural Revolution in the late 70s and the early 80s. And this is when Li Keqiang's hanging around with his democracy gang on Peking University. And, you know, they've all had these kind of really broader life experiences. So, you know, it's got to affect the way you view your job of running the countries somehow.
But one thing that's still true is that all of them have lived their entire careers in China. And that's different from the next generation after them, which often worked or studied or at least traveled abroad, except for some of the more technocrats who are not necessarily party insiders, but maybe managing key aspects of the economy and have had interactions, in that way. Most of the core party members, it was not advantageous for them to study or work abroad. It was a China only experience.
Whereas now,
that's very different now. I mean, if you look at the children of Xi Jinping's daughter, if you look at Bo Xilai's son, these are people who. I don't know what they're getting out of the experience. I guess it depends on the person, but they're certainly they're much more cosmopolitan and much more well traveled.
Speaking of Bo Xilai's son, anyone hear from Guagua recently?
I think he puts very the two bull watchers on his, conditions of communications. But if I had heard from Paul Guagua, I think put it the other way: if you were in his shoes, it would be a very confusing and bewildering experience. So he's just waking up to the fact that he probably won't see his parents outside of jail for
ever,
close to ever. Right. Just like his own father lost his mother in the Cultural Revolution, history's kind of repeating itself in some sense. He's marooned in the United States. He's been brought up to believe that he's had that he is the chosen child. His grandparents and his parents just thought he was God gave him everything. And he's gone off and got, from his point of view, and it's true as well, he had a genuinely challenging education at Oxford and Harvard. He's got money, presumably lots of it, and he's got nothing to do with it. It's one of the great interesting
questions. But he's also now unemployable in the West, at least, and definitely in China. He can't come back to China, and no company, Western company, is going to try and tap him for his great guanxi in China, right?
So, not yet, Jamil, but give it another 5-10 years. This town is full of people who once stabbed other people in the back.
Are there second acts in Chinese politics? I think there are. I think there can be second and third acts in Chinese politics.
But it'll take a while.
Let's move on now. Our time is coming to an end. Let's move to the segment where we make recommendations. I'm going to start really quick and just blow a little smoke up of Patrick's ass here. He did an excellent – it was actually, in May of 2011 that you put out this primer on leadership transition.
Yes.
On your blog. I think I've actually recommended it on this podcast before, but I think it's still – it really holds up. Holds up in very good stead. Jeremy, you've seen this before, right? Patrick's infamous primer. Yeah.
Yes. That's the thing I recommend if people want to get a quick understanding of who the players are.
And how the system works, the trifecta of positions that you hold and how everything, right? Anyway, so I want to recommend that. We'll put a link to that, of course, on the recommendations page. John, why don't you go next?
Look, it's a similar thing. I'm sure it's not as good as Patrick's, but Susan Lawrence at the U.S. Congressional Office has done a terrific paper back in May this year on all the nitty-gritty that you kind of think you know, but you don't really know about how the Central Committee elects, in quotation marks, the Politburo and how it all fits together. So you can find that. Google Susan Lawrence and the U.S. Congressional Research.
That's also excellent. I think we've actually also made that recommendation before on this podcast. Susan Lawrence and somebody else wrote that with her. I can't remember the co-author. I apologize to you. It was a guy, and the name is slipping my mind right now. Patrick, you're up.
I'm going to go off the reservation a little bit and suggest some things that are not directly about China but impact China quite a bit and are going to have a huge effect. The first is a book called The Eskimo and the Oil Man by Bob Rice. This is a book about Alaska's North Slope. Uh-huh. What he talks about is how the Arctic ice is receding. Now, whether that's due to natural reasons or man-made, He actually doesn't venture a guess, but he talks really about the practical impacts of this. The opening sea lanes and the ability to access natural resources all around the Arctic Circle. And this is having – China's thinking a great deal about this because first of all, you know, China's a resource-hungry country, both in terms of oil and also minerals. They actually want now to get onto the Arctic Council to have a say in this because it holds the potential not just to tap some resources there, but also to ship them much more cheaply to China and also avoid the strategic bottleneck of the Straits of Malacca. So actually the Bering Straits may be as a
strategically great important
strategic yeah. importance as the Straits of Malacca are now to China. The other thing that I would recommend is an article that I read yesterday in the Wall Street Journal about how cheap natural gas is a big boost to U.S. Rust Belt. And the reason why this matters to China is that I was talking with the head of a major chemical company just the other day, and he said, you know, in the past 10 years or the past 20 years, if you were going to build a cracker, is a petrochemical plant, it was a no-brainer that you were going to build it in Asia. Now you're going to build it in the United States because of cheap natural gas and this energy-intensive process. And that actually he said that it's possible that the plastics industry may relocate from Asia, in particular China, to the United States, which would be a very significant shift.
I mean, of course, the cheapening of natural gas is due to our technological advances in being able to extract shale gas, right? Isn't shale gas also available in China? I mean, isn't it something that could theoretically be accessed?
There is, but my understanding, and again, I'm not an expert on this, this is what I've been told, is that the resources are actually far deeper and less accessible, and also, the process is very water intensive,
right?
And the places where China has these resources are the arid regions of northern and western China,
right.
And there's not enough water right now. The water table is going down just on current use, and so it's very difficult. There are new technologies that are less water intensive that are being developed, but that's why China is so hungry to acquire those technologies, and,
sure.
and it's possible that you know some of this interest in acquiring, I would say Nexen, but the Nexen type companies is to acquire that technology.
That technology, water is the new oil, as they say. Jamil, what do you have for us?
So I would like to recommend Alexis de Tocqueville's Ancien Régime and the French Revolution, I've been told two different versions, but one is that Li Keqiang is recommending it to many of his colleagues, and the other story is that Wang Shishan is maybe they both are recommending it at the moment. But so I'd like to recommend it too. If they're recommending it, there must be something.
It's the basis of a faction. We're calling it the Tocqueville faction.
What's the main takeaway for the Chinese leadership?
How to avoid
a revolution. Right. No, I mean, that's the obvious thing. I think I've talked to a few people about this. I actually I've only just started it, so I haven't read the whole way through, but I've talked to some people who've read it and have sort of made some links. And one thing is that I think de Tocqueville says that one of the biggest problems was not that there was a huge drop in the economy. It was that things got better for quite a long time, and the expectations were raised much
right.
higher than
stalled revolution of rising expectations.
Exactly. So I think they, you know, that is a real concern for China's leaders, is that after 30 years of rapid economic growth, even you know, still high but lower economic growth could spark off, you know, real disgruntlement in China. So that's one takeaway that some people have
Marie made. Antoinette here is already in jail, though. So
yeah, well,
and I guess
there are a few others who could take up that.
From
that
my
role.
Cliff Notes understanding of it, I also seem to recall that it was when they began to reform that the revolution
exactly.
Took
that's
place.
Right. So it was exactly. So when they started to bring in,
it wasn't a refusal to reform.
It was the. Exactly like the Qing dynasty.
Exactly,
right?
Very eerie parallels to the Qing.
The late
right.
Qing, where they started to try and come up with a new plan, and
right.
that's when
post-Boxer uprising
fell apart.
Very good. So Alexis Tocqueville's the Ancien Régime. And Jeremy,
I just got one that is a little bit facetious, but not entirely. CCTV's English website has published 5 glorious years in China, which is a look back at the last 5 years and the great achievements of the Chinese Communist Party.
By Jeremy Goldcorn.
No, it wasn't by me, actually. It's a bit of an odd list. I mean, it's basically spaceships, Olympics, Expo, suppressing and educating Tibetans, and then making policy noises about inequality in rural people. I mean, that's how it's summed up. But I think it's worth reading for not understanding how people think about the future, but understanding how the current regime is trying to see its place in history. And they have a distinct lack of poetry and vision in their view of themselves.
They're a bunch of engineers.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I've heard they write good couplets once in a while. Anyway, John Gardeau, thank you very much for coming.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
And Patrick Chovanec, very good to have you, man. And we'll have you back again soon.
I look forward to it.
Jamil Adelini from Financial Times, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much.
And Jeremy, as always. So let us sign off for now, and we will see you next week with another episode of the Seneca Podcast. Take care.